Part 1. What is total motivation? High-performing cultures begin with a surprisingly simple building block, your people's why. 1. The motive spectrum. The 6 reasons we work. The United Arab Emirates, UAE, has a serious problem. Too many of its citizens are overweight or obese. In the summer of 2013, the government of Dubai took action, launching a weight loss challenge it called Your Weight in Gold. Dubai followed a playbook that many companies have used to change people's behavior. It offered a reward. For every kilogram of weight that residents lost between July and mid-August, it would pay them 1 gram of gold. That seems like a reasonable strategy. After all, people will do a lot more than diet in the pursuit of gold. And, sure enough, when the contest ended, about 25% of the 10,666 people who entered the challenge had lost enough weight to claim a prize. Big success, right? Not exactly. Scientists have studied what happens when people are paid to lose weight, and the results are not very encouraging. Consider this experiment, conducted by 4 university researchers. Coincidentally, its design is very similar to Your Weight in Gold. During a 3-week program, test subjects were paid about $50 per week, roughly the value of a gram of gold, to lose weight. After the program ended, their weight was tracked for another 4 months. But before it all began, the test subjects' motives for joining the program were assessed. Why were they there? Imagine 2 hypothetical test subjects, Jake and Christine. Jake sees the flyer for the experiment and decides to sign up because he needs the money. The money is his motive. Christine sees the same flyer and decides it would be a great opportunity to lose weight. For her, the money is not the main factor. She's there for the learning, the coaching, and the community. Jake and the other test subjects like him formed the financially motivated group. Christine and the other subjects like her formed the non-financially motivated group. As you'd expect, Jake and the financially motivated group lost weight, 0.25% of their weight on average. It looked like the financial reward had somewhat successfully motivated behavior. Mission accomplished. Not so fast. After they'd collected their rewards, Jake and his group went on to gain weight. Over the next 4 months, Jake and his group gained back the weight they had lost and added more on top of that. The reward might have instigated behavior, but it didn't build persistence. Meanwhile, Christine and her group saw better results. On average, they lost about 1.5% of their weight, 6 times what Jake lost, during the program. Over the next 4 months, they kept the weight off and lost even more, another 0.5%. The experiment has a simple yet profound lesson. Why people participate in an activity affects their performance in that activity. Their motive affects their performance. Even though many organizations rely on money to drive performance, most of us know, from our personal lives, that motivation is much more complicated. There is a spectrum of reasons why people do their jobs or lose weight. Understanding that spectrum is the key to creating the highest levels of performance. The motive spectrum. Before we can explain a phenomenon scientifically, it is easy to mistake it for magic. When we speak with leaders about culture building, they often tell us that it takes special powers of the kind that only a Steve Jobs, Apple, Herb Kelleher, Southwest Airlines, Phil Jackson, legendary coach of the Chicago Bulls and LA Lakers, or some other wizard is graced with. What hope do mere mortals have? A good first step in turning magic into science is the creation of a framework that helps make predictions. Ideally, this framework organizes all of your scientific observations in a way that helps you see new patterns. This is what happened with alchemy. Alchemists believed that all matter was composed of earth, air, fire, and water. For centuries, they mixed and remixed materials in an attempt to produce the mythical Philosopher's Stone, which they believed had the power to transform base metals, like iron, into gold, and to confer immortality. Instead, they discovered chemistry. Chemistry took its biggest leap forward in 1869, when the Russian chemist Dmitri Mendeleev produced the periodic table of elements. "I saw in a dream a table where all elements fell into place as required," he said later. "Awakening, I immediately wrote it down on a piece of paper." Thanks to this organizing framework, Mendeleev was able to predict the properties of elements that have not yet been discovered. What had once been magic was now firmly in the realm of science. In our own day, an analogous discovery has sparked a great flowering of the science of human performance. In the mid-1980s, Edward L. Deci and Richard M. Ryan of the University of Rochester published an audacious framework of human motives, a single spectrum cataloging the reasons that people engage in activities. They called it self-determination theory. Their seminal book, Intrinsic Motivation and Self-Determination in Human Behavior, has been cited over 22,000 times in other research. Compare that to the average number of citations a paper gets after 10 years. Just 20. We've been deeply influenced by Deci and Ryan in our own research and practice. A deeper explanation of how we have built on their and other researchers' work can be found in the appendix, The Scientist's Toothbrush. It turns out that there is a spectrum of reasons, or motives, for why people perform an activity. The first three, which we call the direct motives, are directly linked to the activity, in our case, work, and drive performance. The next three, the indirect motives, are further removed from the work itself and frequently harm performance. Let's go through the motives one by one, starting with play. The direct motives. Play. You're most likely to lose weight or succeed in any other endeavor when your motive is play. Play occurs when you're engaging in an activity simply because you enjoy doing it. The work itself is its own reward. Scientists describe this motive as intrinsic. Play is what compels you to take up hobbies, from solving crossword puzzles to making scrapbooks to mixing music. You may find play in weight loss by experimenting with healthy recipes or seeking out new restaurants that offer healthy options. Many of us are lucky enough to find play in the workplace, too, when we do what we do simply because we enjoy doing it. Curiosity and experimentation are at the heart of play. People intrinsically enjoy learning and adapting. We instinctively seek out opportunities to play. Some companies actively encourage their employees to play in their work. Toyota gives factory workers the opportunity to come up with and test new tools and ideas on the assembly line. W. L. Gore and Associates, Google, and a number of other companies encourage play by giving people free time or resources to explore their own ideas. Zappos and Southwest Airlines encourage their people to treat each customer interaction as play. In each case, the organization encourages its people to indulge their curiosity, to play in the work itself. Play at work should not be confused with your people playing ping pong or foosball in the break room. For your people to play at work, the motive must be fueled by the work itself, not the distraction. Because the play motive is created by the work itself, play is the most direct and most powerful driver of high performance. Purpose. A step away from the work itself is the purpose motive. The purpose motive occurs when you do an activity because you value the outcome of the activity versus the activity itself. You may or may not enjoy the work you do, but you value its impact. You may work as a nurse, for example, because you want to heal patients. You spend your career studying culture because you believe in the impact your work can have on others. Dieters may not enjoy preparing or eating healthy meals, but they deeply value their own health, an outcome of healthy eating. You feel the purpose motive in the workplace when your values and beliefs align with the impact of the work. Apple creates products that inspire and empower its customers. a purpose that is compelling and credible. The medical devices that Medtronic makes save lives. When its engineers and technicians see their products in action, it has a powerful effect on them. Walmart's financial services division fuels purpose by kicking off its management meetings with a review of how much money the division has saved its customers, rather than how much money Walmart has made for itself. As you'll see in the coming chapters, a thoughtful organization can create authentic purpose for just about any type of work. Yet, one of the biggest mistakes a company can make is trumpeting a grandiose purpose that isn't authentic. If a purpose doesn't feel credible, it doesn't affect your motive. The purpose motive is one step removed from the work, because the motive isn't the work itself, but its outcome. While the purpose motive is a powerful driver of performance, the fact that it's a step removed from the work typically makes it a less powerful motive than play. Potential. The third motive is potential. The potential motive occurs when you find a second-order outcome versus a direct outcome of the work that aligns with your values or beliefs. You do the work because it will eventually lead to something you believe is important, such as your personal goals. For example, you may work as a paralegal because it will help you get into law school. You may not enjoy the day-to-day work of filing briefs, no play motive. And you may not care about helping the kinds of clients your firm represents, no purpose motive, but you continue to do the job because you want to be a public defender one day. You are working to bring about a second-order outcome that you do believe in. Dieters motivated by potential eat healthfully to achieve other things they care about, the ability to run faster on the football field, for example, or to keep up with their kids. When a company describes a job as a good stepping stone, they're attempting to instill the potential motive. Some companies go out of their way to enhance the potential motive, offering classes that build skills or knowledge. General Electric draws talent through its reputation as the leadership factory for future CEOs. The potential motive is not as powerful as play or purpose, since it relates to a second-order outcome of the work, which is two or more steps removed from the work itself. We call play, purpose, and potential the direct motives because they're the most directly connected to the work itself. As a result, they typically result in the highest levels of performance. If you remember only one thing from Primed to Perform, it should be that a culture that inspires people to do their jobs for play, purpose, and potential creates the highest and most sustainable performance. You would think that the more reasons you give someone to work, the more dedicated they would be. But not all motives lead to higher levels of performance. Moving further along the motive spectrum, we reach the indirect motives, motives that are no longer connected to the work itself. These typically reduce performance. The indirect motives. Emotional pressure. The first indirect motive, emotional pressure, occurs when emotions such as disappointment, guilt, or shame compel you to perform an activity. These emotions are related to your beliefs, your self-perception, and external forces, the judgments of other people. The work itself is no longer the reason you're working. You may practice the piano so you don't disappoint your mother. You may stay in a job because its prestige boosts your self-esteem. A dieter may eat healthy meals because he's embarrassed by how he looks, or because he feels guilty when his partner catches him with his hand in the cookie jar. In each case, the motive is not directly connected to the work. It is indirect. Have you ever looked at your Facebook newsfeed and thought to yourself, "Everyone in the world is having fun right now except for me"? Then you feel compelled to go to a club that evening. Your action, going to the club, isn't driven by the play you feel in dancing or socializing. Instead, it's driven by the emotional pressure created by your news feed, a phenomenon known as FOMO, or fear of missing out. When your motive to work is emotional pressure, your performance tends to suffer. We see the impact of emotional pressure in workplaces everywhere. For example, a junior employee in a meeting with a senior executive is so worried about what the executive thinks of him that he chokes under pressure. Emotional pressure can cause fear of public speaking or writer's block when the fear of judgment distracts you from the actual activity. High-performing cultures reduce emotional pressure. Medallia, a fast-growing technology company, teaches people how to be vulnerable in their week-long onboarding program for new employees. One asset management firm, where financial managers are usually wrong more than 40% of the time, brought in an Olympic coach to help them cope with the fear of failure. When people work because of emotional pressure, their motivation is no longer connected to the work itself, so their performance tends to suffer. But emotional pressure is the weakest of the three indirect motives. The effects of economic pressure can be much worse. Economic pressure. Economic pressure is when you do an activity solely to win a reward or avoid punishment. The motive is separate from the work itself and separate from your own identity. See Figure 3 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook for an illustration of this separation. In business, this often occurs when you're trying to gain a bonus or a promotion, avoid being fired, or escape the bullying of an angry boss. Economic pressure can occur outside the workplace whenever you feel forced to do something. Put yourself in the place of a marketer who completes what she thinks is a pointless blog post because her bonus requires her to publish 10 a quarter. Or a Los Angeles talent agent's assistant who is required to join his boss's training for a marathon. In each case, something separate from the work itself, a bonus, a boss, was compelling behavior. The biggest misconception about the economic motive is that it is strictly a matter of money. In a study we conducted involving more than 10,000 workers, we looked to see how the economic motive changes with household income. We expected to find that the people with the least income experienced the highest economic pressure. Instead, we learned that income and economic motive were statistically unrelated. People at any income level can feel economic pressure at work. This is an important insight. Money alone does not cause the economic motive. We saw this play out with the dieters in the weight loss experiment. While all of them could earn financial rewards, some were dieting because of the reward, while others were not. If money is the sole reason you're participating in an activity, it will typically diminish performance. If you're participating for other reasons, money won't cause a problem. This is why we need to understand all the motives together. Imagine a Boy Scout who learns how to play chess so he can earn a merit badge, for example. He doesn't actually care about chess. He just wants the badge. This Boy Scout has an economic motive. Another Boy Scout may learn chess because he really enjoys learning or because he's fascinated by chess. This Scout will also earn a badge, but the badge wasn't his reason for learning. His motive was play. All other things being equal, the odds are that the Boy Scout motivated by play will beat the Boy Scout with the economic motive in a match. As you'll see throughout Primed to Perform, money itself is not the core issue. There are situations where money works and situations where it doesn't. It all depends on whether or not the reward or punishment is the motive behind the activity, and whether the activity would benefit from adaptive performance. Inertia. The most indirect motive of all is inertia. With inertia, your motive for working is so distant from the work itself that you can no longer say where it comes from. You do what you do simply because you did it yesterday. This leads to the worst performance of all. A university student may continue to attend school purely because of inertia. He's on the path already, so he just keeps slogging. An executive continues at his job not because he's engaged in it, but because he can't think of a good reason to leave. One CEO of a company in the technology industry boasted about his great employee retention, but when we spoke to his employees, it was clear to us that inertia accounted for their retention, not play, purpose, or potential. It isn't enough to have employees who stay. You want them to stay for the right reasons. As destructive and insidious as it is, inertia is surprisingly common in the workplace. In our research, we've found that a large proportion of the employee population feels like they work in their current job for no good reason. Zappos, the online shoe retailer, has found a clever way to nip this condition in the bud. After 4 weeks of new hire training, it offers 1 month's salary to anyone who quits. Zappos doesn't want anyone hanging around just because. Why we work. If using emotional and economic pressure to inspire weight loss doesn't work, then what does? When human performance expert Luke G. Palacio and his colleagues conducted a formal study of the relationship between the six motives and dieting, they found that play, purpose, and potential led to better eating behaviors. Emotional pressure, economic pressure, and inertia made things worse. Their research, and the research of hundreds of others, gives us the two key findings of the motive spectrum. 1. Direct motives typically increase performance, and indirect motives typically decrease it. This point can be difficult to swallow, so Chapter 3, Rethinking Performance, shares more on why this is true. 2. The more directly connected the motive is to the activity itself, the better performance becomes. Play is the motive that is closest to the work itself, so it is the most powerful. Purpose is one step removed, so it is the second strongest. Potential is two or more steps removed from the activity, so it is the third strongest. See Figure 3 on the enhancement for an illustration. Together, these two insights define total motivation, TOMO for short. High levels of total motivation occur when a person feels more of the direct motives and less of the indirect motives. Total motivation is the foundation of any high-performing culture. Author Dan Pink explains this finding eloquently in his best-selling book, Drive, which introduced a whole generation of leaders to the concept of intrinsic motivation. In business, we tend to obsess over the how, as in, here's how to do it. Yet we rarely discuss the why, as in, here's why we're doing it. But it's often difficult to do something exceptionally well if we don't know the reasons we're doing it in the first place. Betting on the underdog. One of our early breakthrough applications of the science of the motive spectrum to the business world was in the customer service call center of a bank's consumer loans business. We've disguised some details of this story to protect the client's anonymity. The typical call center isn't known for its warm decor or feng shui. A sign outside this one, which also doubles as a tornado shelter, reminds employees that no guns are allowed inside. Its people work in rows upon rows of cubicles in a space that's big enough to hold several football fields. There's no ping-pong table, no fully stocked kitchen, and no official corporate masseuse. One customer service agent, Eric, had left a career as a school teacher to better support his wife and two kids. He spent all day on the phone, sometimes answering inbound calls, but usually convincing people not to hang up when he dialed them. He spoke to hundreds of people a week. His job, or so he was told, was to handle the calls quickly. He felt like a cog in a giant machine. The call center used all the best practices of the day. Experts created scripts of talking points, giving the agents the exact words they should use with their customers. The agents themselves had functional specialties, so they could focus on only one task. The center as a whole had a bold yet achievable goal that was broken down into specific sub-goals for each team and individual. To keep morale high, a stuffed monkey was placed on top of the cube of the worker who'd had the best day. Bonuses were based on performance, which was reviewed by managers in weekly meetings. But none of those practices increased direct motives or reduced indirect ones. Instead, they did exactly the reverse. We made a bet with our client. We said that by building a team culture that maximized total motivation, we could get the lowest performers in the shop to perform better than the status quo. Due to his own low TOMO, our client was eager to see us lose our bet. Another issue with this organization's culture. The team we put together included not only some of the call center's worst performers, but also some complete newbies who'd never made a professional call in their lives. During our first meeting with the team, we went around the table, introducing ourselves. "My name is Rick," said one of our soon-to-be agents. You may recognize me because until today, I was the security guard of the building. Our Bad News Bears had 6 months to beat the incumbents. To the surprise and chagrin of everyone watching, the first thing we did was reduce the economic pressure. We wouldn't advocate this in every case, but for this experiment, we eliminated incentive compensation and increased base pay. We also eliminated all the performance management reviews that were designed to ramp up emotional pressure. Lastly, we gave our team the opportunity to opt in, reducing their inertia. Then we focused on play. Previously, the company had devoted most of its energy to ensuring that employees followed the large number of laws and regulations involved in consumer lending. We too made sure that the rules were clear, but we spent half of our time helping the group understand where they had the freedom to experiment and explore through creativity and problem solving. In other words, where they could play. We did away with their scripts. We launched daily huddles in which the agents helped each other figure out complicated cases. We installed a hotline to get quick approvals for non-standard courses of action. The highlight of each week was the Monday working meeting, where agents presented their most difficult cases to three levels of management and collectively brainstormed solutions. To increase purpose, we gave every agent his own set of customers, 200 people he would work with from the beginning to the end of their journey. It was the middle of the financial crisis, and many of those customers had lost their jobs and were seeking to modify their loans. Each agent could now see the impact his or her work was having on customers' lives. Managers started talking about their group's purpose, helping customers in need. They emphasized new values, like always asking for help if it would benefit a customer. Whenever a customer was helped through some Herculean effort, the story was celebrated. Eric started hustling to make sure the families he now knew personally got their paperwork in on time. Rick became a master in calming frightened customers. Lakeisha beamed when she found a new source of income for a retiree and became an expert in figuring out customer cash flows. As team members found ways to improve their own performance, they would share their newfound skills with their peers. Their energy was palpable. Better yet, their performance went through the roof. At the end of the day, our team didn't just surpass the status quo. It beat it by 200%. All this in an industry known for being slow to change and in a job function whose workers were traditionally treated like automatons. A senior executive of the bank eventually interviewed the agents to find out how we could have found so much upside in a call center that had supposedly been optimized long before. The most experienced agent told him, "I've been with the bank for 15 years, and this is the first time I felt like what I did mattered. For the longest time, what we were doing didn't feel right," another said. "Now our work, the interests of the bank, and the interests of the customer are all the same." We realized something important. The why changes the how. When people were driven by the direct motives, they started doing their work differently. They went above and beyond. These results shouldn't come as a surprise. One of the thinkers who has greatly influenced our work, Adam Grant, a Wharton professor and author of the book Give and Take, carried out a formal study of a sales force at a company that had eliminated financial incentives after salespeople falsified data to earn commissions. Chapter 3, Rethinking Performance, includes more on how the motive spectrum can influence bad behavior. He found that after controlling for tactical performance, for example, the number of calls a person made, those with low direct motives and high indirect motives, like a person with little play but lots of economic pressure, produced about $234 in revenue per hour. On the other hand, those with the highest total motivation, like a person with the play motive and little economic pressure, sold $375 per hour. That's a 60% difference from a factor that few leaders actively manage and few cultures are designed to encourage. Going forward, the first question we now ask anyone who is trying to build a great culture is, why do your people come to work every day? If they come to work because their organization inspires the direct motives, play, purpose, and potential, they are likely performing at their best. If the culture is dominated by indirect motives, emotional pressure, economic pressure, or inertia, their performance is likely to be much worse. Take a moment to ask yourself how the motive spectrum affects your life as a leader, parent, teacher, or coach. Where do you find play, purpose, and potential in your daily activities? When have you made a decision because of emotional pressure, economic pressure, or inertia? What motivates your colleagues at work? Do you tend to motivate others through play, purpose, and potential? Or do you use emotional or economic pressure? The motive spectrum is the periodic table of great cultures, a systematic organizing framework for the relationships between work, motivation, and performance. While every great culture has a unique personality, behind each and every one of them is the science of the motive spectrum. Using its insights, any culture can be re-engineered for the better.